You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Episode 99, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Welcome to The Paradox. I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. Thank you for joining me as we explore the U.S. medical system in a fun, informative format through expert analysis. Today's expert is Dr. Rohan Francis. Dr. Francis is an interventional cardiologist who is doing PhD work in cardiac MRI, which is where our discussion will begin today as we discuss the recent concerns about myocarditis in people who are recovering from COVID, either symptomatically or asymptomatically. This has caused a lot of disruption in sports leagues and university settings with concern about potentially long-lasting heart failure and heart problems with young adults. I suspect you'll find this conversation hopeful and helpful in your conversations with either patients or other people who have concerns about this. I think this will put a lot of them to rest and hopefully help allay some of those concerns people might have. Today's episode is the last episode before Episode 100, obviously. It's been quite a journey. As those of you who have been following the show for a while know that a lot of things have transpired since I began the show. I began this in April of 2018, so clearly I have not done one every week as my plan, but I've been fairly faithful and I've almost managed that. Those of you who are not familiar with the personal issues I've gone through, I'd recommend you listen to episode 25 where I talk about the death of my son, Andy. He died in August of 2018 in a car accident. It's a tough episode to listen to, but if you want to know what sorts of things I've had to go through and my family, I think it's a good listen. It's very raw, but it's also part of the reason why I haven't been able to keep as faithful to the weekly episodes as I had planned. For those of you who listen all the way to the end of the show, you may notice that it has a very non-medical ending, in that after the theme music, there's a solo for my son when he was at the Grand Rapids Choir of Men and Boys singing a Christmas solo in December of 2017. He was incredibly talented, and he was probably the one who gave me the hardest time about the podcast, where he'd always ask me weekly, it seemed, if my show had yet gone viral. It's safe to say it hasn't, but I've got a nice niche, and people who listen and share it, and you have helped make it successful and send me great ideas. And so for that, I'm very thankful and appreciate this opportunity to convey some information and you can learn alongside with me. I, of course, like to thank, as always, the patrons to the show who help financially offset the cost for the production, the technology that's required, Zoom conferencing, microphones, hosting services, and the like. If you want to be a part of that, obviously you can do that anytime. I'd appreciate any sort of support you have financially. You can do that at patreon.com/theparadox. More importantly, if you subscribe to the show, share it with your friends, please feel free to send me messages to me at theparadoxshow@protonmail.com. There I use the show ideas. I find people to interview. I've got some interesting interviews coming up in the future, all thanks to basically listeners like you who give me ideas and give me the opportunity to reach out to people I never would have imagined talking to, and then yet they reply, and here they are on the show. So I consider that one of the great benefits of the show, that I've been able to expand my reach, and certainly I've been able to interact with people that I never thought possible. And so I hope you've enjoyed that aspect of the show as much as I have. But with all that being said, we'll just get down to the nuts and bolts of things. Obviously, show notes will be where they usually are, at theparadox.com/099. There you can find links to Dr. Francis' YouTube page, which is called Midlife Crisis. He's also on Twitter. That'll be linked as well. I'd highly recommend you go watch his videos. They're entertaining, informative, which is absolutely why I had him on my show today. But without further ado, my conversation with Dr. Rohin Francis about COVID and myocarditis. Enjoy. Well, I'm here with my new friend, Dr. Rohin Francis of Midlife Crisis, a YouTube channel. He's a cardiologist in the UK, London. He's working on his PhD in cardiac MRI, although he specializes in interventional cardiology. Dr. Francis, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
Well, let's get right into the thick of it, because I had you on. You had a great video that you put out recently on cardiac MRI. And so why don't you briefly talk about cardiac MRI and then how that relates to COVID?
Sure. Well, I mean, cardiac MRI is one of the many tools we've got available to us in cardiology, but I think it's fair to say it's a pretty specialized test. A typical cardiac MRI scan will take in the region of a half hour to an hour. So we get a lot of information. It's not something we do routinely, but it's a very sensitive test. And it's inevitable that, you know, I think COVID's been such a scrutinized disease that all of us in our different fields turn the tools that we've got onto it and see if we can come up with any new information or clues about what to do. And for the majority of the last few months, I think people have been concentrating on the sickest patients with COVID, which makes sense, obviously. That's where all the resources were. But more recently, people have been trying to turn an eye to the future and look at, you know, what maybe are going to be the long-term effects of COVID. And one of the papers, there have been quite a few using cardiac MRI to image people with COVID, but often those particularly sick patients. So there was one recently which has gained a lot of coverage around the world, which turned the attention onto patients who had recovered from COVID-19. So they were no longer sick and did cardiac MRIs on their hearts. And this is, I guess, going to form a lot of what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, this important, I mean, I think most people are familiar with their MRI. Cardiac MRI specialized looks at the functionality of the heart while it's working, which is unusual, I mean, in the sense that most of the MRIs are static images when they were initially developed. And this can actually show you the contractility, how much, you know, is moving through the heart, right? And it can show you the actual tissue so that you can identify with some certainty, I suppose, whether there's inflammation, right? That's the itis of myocarditis that we talk about. So we have to be very careful with our terminology here, I think, because, you know, I've been very loose with it, and I'm going to try and get better about that. Where, for instance, you could be infected with SARS-CoV-2 and not actually have COVID-19, in the sense that you don't exhibit any symptoms of disease. And so COVID-19 is actually like, it's sort of like having polio versus having the polio viruses that actually don't cause any disease, you know, because you don't have, you may have be vaccinated, so you don't exhibit any symptoms, and so you don't actually have polio, but you may actually have the viruses and can potentially shed them in your, you know, GI tract. So the same could possibly be said with SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19. And so when we're talking about this, we're talking about people who actually exhibited symptoms in some level had COVID-19, so they had disease that where they had some sort of symptoms. And then I guess the question is, you know, how significant are these findings, right? So we can go looking for all sorts of things and find abnormalities, but sometimes abnormalities are actually normal, or there's a variant. And so it's hard for us to know in medicine sometimes what is significant, I guess, in our findings. That's a lot of sort of, I think, how to start begin the framing this discussion. Would you agree?
Yes, I think there are a few important points there to expand on. The key one being that, you know, what defines an abnormality? And I think we can often think about this a bit in a bit too much of a binary manner, that there's normal and there's abnormal, whereas, you know, nothing biological really exists like that. There's always going to be a bit of a spectrum. And I think, you know, if you look with enough different technologies and modalities, you'll find things in everyone. And some of those things will be classed as definitely abnormal, but some fall into a gray area. And the other point I wanted to emphasize in what you just said was about terminology. And I think there's central to this conversation has been a conflation of two bits of terminology: myocarditis, which is a clinical syndrome where someone typically has symptoms, which may be in the form of chest pain or palpitation, something like that, in association with some sort of diagnostic test, whether that's a raised inflammatory blood marker or whether it's an abnormality on a cardiac MRI scan. But a lot of the patients that have been discussed and the results that were found, which I'll summarize in a second, if you like, were just something lighting up on an MRI scan without the other associated symptoms of myocarditis, like the raised blood test or the person actually feeling any symptoms. So that's been referred to as myocarditis, but I would just suggest that actually it's not clearly cut as myocarditis. That is maybe, right. I think we're mixing up a bit of terminology there as well. Would you like me to sort of just briefly summarize what the paper said?
Please. Yeah. Why don't you go into that? And I think it's a great separation of the myocarditis, because as a term, as all these things, we just throw them around because it's the only way you can describe something that you normally would not have known existed, right? I mean, you would know that there was an inflammation that is maybe subclinical or irrelevant, but since it's there, you say, well, I guess it's myocarditis, even though there's, you know, it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a concept we're familiar with in medicine on the whole, but it seems that in this particular topic, we seem to have, I don't know, thrown a bit of common sense to the wind, or we seem to have forgotten the way we think about information we get otherwise. You know, a classic example being the C-reactive protein, a non-specific blood test of inflammation, which goes up in all kinds of things, acute illness. And so sometimes you'll send off the test or another test like a troponin and it'll come back a bit abnormal. And then you kind of scratch your head and think, well, you know, this patient seems perfectly well to me. Well, let's just repeat it in a couple of weeks and then it's normal. And it's just one of those things. And, you know, probably no cause will ever be found. But as long as your patient's okay, that's the kind of main thing. So I think that's a similar kind of phenomenon. But this was a German study initially. I mean, there have been a few different things that have been published, but this certainly was the one that has been at the center of the conversation. And I think it's important to say there was nothing really wrong with the study. It's more to do with how it's been interpreted. There was an error which was quickly corrected, but I think in the grand scheme of things, it's probably not so important to dwell on that. But it was a look at about 100 people who'd recovered from a clinical syndrome of COVID-19. So they were sick and they'd got better. And that was antibody proven illness. And that was RNA proven illness. And they put them in the MRI scanner and found that initially what was reported was 78% had abnormalities, things that we wouldn't expect to see on a normal, doing inverted commas here, a normal patient. And to that end, they had got some normal controls in the study. But normal controls aren't, you've got to be a bit more specific with what that means. So the majority of people who are getting unwell, significantly unwell with COVID-19, tend to be those who are a bit older, who've got some potentially some pre-existing medical conditions. So if you get a bunch of 25-year-olds who are completely healthy as your normal controls, and you're comparing those to people who've recovered from COVID-19 who are over the age of 50 on average, then you're not necessarily comparing like for like. And normal controls, ordinarily, you know, we do research in universities, and it often is young, fit people. So what they had done is then add another group who were risk factor matched controls, who were much more appropriate as people to compare to. So they're of a similar kind of demographic, similar medical background, but didn't have COVID-19. The way that the results were reported was taking all three groups into account. So some of the differences came out strongly significant. But if you ignore those normal controls and just look at the risk factor match controls, in the republished data that had some statistical abnormalities corrected, actually, it doesn't look like there's a significant difference between someone who has had COVID-19 and recovered and someone who is of a similar kind of medical background and age, but didn't have COVID-19. They also have these abnormalities on their cardiac MRI tests, but they're more likely, or they are likely to be caused by those other medical problems rather than the COVID-19.
Yeah, and I guess this is not surprising. I mean, this is kind of what you'd expect to see. I guess we don't know enough about the disease, but this kind of goes more broadly into the discussion, I guess, with the media and scientists and the interplay between the two. And it's real easy to jump on the media and say, well, you know, they're scaremongering, which they clearly are. They're, you know, it's clickbait. There's, you know, they're always talking about things. And I would just point out a recent headline we had in the USA Today, which is a paper that I'm not sure anyone actually reads in this country, but their headlines are always in. And one of the headline read, three teachers have already died from COVID-19. We've gone back to school here in the United States in the fall. There's a lot of controversy whether the kids should go back to school or whether they shouldn't. And, you know, the teachers have been making a big deal about their, you know, hazard pay or the risk of teaching. And of course, you read the article and none of the three teachers died contracting it in school, right? I mean, that was the headline assumption is, of course, that teachers are going back to school and they're, you know, dropping like flies as dangerous, when in fact they got it. One got a teacher meeting, the other two got it some other time in the summer and died. I mean, it was, and most of them were teaching virtually anyway. So, but I think that is definitely a problem with the media. But I think scientists are feeding this as much as the media is reporting it, right? I mean, I think people are pushing out press releases, preprints, things that haven't peer reviewed for their studies. And it's putting a lot of information out there that is very confusing. And in some way, I don't expect the media to be able to sort of sort through this sort of thing, but I think it's I don't know who's responsible. Except I think in many ways, I think the science and research, basic researchers, are causing a lot of the problems, maybe unintentionally, but looking for, I don't know, a couple interviews, fame. I mean, normally no one cares about cardiac MRI, right? Except cardiologists and radiologists. But now suddenly, people care what I say, and so they're going to push this forward to get in the print or, you know, to get published.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that's a huge problem. You know, I looked at these stats several weeks ago now, so I'm sure it's an order of magnitude more. But there was something like 10,000 papers that had been published about COVID-19. So much of that is just noise and really poor quality, pointless studies and a lot of duplication of the same questions. But I don't think that's necessarily the case for this particular paper. I think, you know, the authors didn't make any sort of big pronouncement about what they advise should be done with this information. I think it's just something that has in just the way we're kind of seizing on anything at the moment. It in this particular context, I think it's a case of maybe, well, I mean, it's a bit academic trying to apportion who's more at fault between right, the and the media. And I think nobody comes out of this doing very well. But in this particular case, I don't have too much problems with the data. It's more just I don't believe that the majority of people are taking away the right message from this. And certainly, you know, the simplistic summary is that 78% of people, and this is what all the headlines were kind of suggesting, have this long-term heart damage, even when they're feeling completely back to normal, and then making wild extrapolations about what the future will hold for these people over the next 5, 10, even, you know, I saw a scientist the other day predicting about a sort of tidal wave of heart failure coming over the next few decades from COVID-19. And I understand, you know, scientists, our job is to come up with hypotheses and ask questions. But I think there has to be a bit of understanding that at the moment, people are hanging off scientists' every word, and they're looking for answers and aren't necessarily able to discriminate between an academic conversation, between people, researchers who are just kind of asking questions. And they'll hear a scientist saying something like that and maybe don't appreciate that this is an opinion. And then it's reported in the media as scientist says, you know, heart failure rates are going to soar because of COVID-19. When, you know, and I think we've got to be very careful making these kind of speculative comments like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just goes along the lines of, you know, someone says report a scientist. Well, all scientists are not the same. Much as, you know, doctor says something, you know, such and such. Well, not all doctors are the same. Some people have more inherent knowledge. My opinion on what goes on in cardiac catheterizations is pretty much worthless. And so I wouldn't expect anyone to take what I say, except unless I've done some research and talked to a bunch of people. But I can maybe understand things a little bit more when it comes to medicine. I can understand an immunologist talking about viruses, but I'm so far from an expert in this. I'm not an expert in epidemiology. I try and figure it out to try and answer these things. And maybe I'm a little bit better at figuring this out than the average person, just because I have a little more experience in it. We sort of speak the jargon, but it makes it, I don't know if it's just, I'm not even sure where we fix the problem, right? Because I think, you know, you look at when someone puts a study out this like this, and people take this information and they make decisions. And I know in one of your videos, I got actually ended up down the YouTube rat hole in your watching video after video of yours. I really enjoy a lot of them, and I recommend it to anyone to go to Midlife Crisis, which will be linked in the show notes. But I found that it's really hard for people to know which person to listen to. And I don't know who's responsible for making sure that the right people listen to those things. You almost need some sort of chief aggregator. But we have people like, we had sports leagues canceled. And in this, I'm in the Midwest here in the United States, and it was our football and, well, all fall sports were canceled because of this study. I mean, I think they were all set to go. And then this study happened in 3 days, sort of hit the media, I should say. And 3 days later, everything was canceled. It was a contributing factor, but I just don't know how you help people know which people to listen to and which things actually matter.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think it's a very difficult question. If only everybody had as much insight as you do into the limits of your expertise. I think the problem is a lot of people have appointed themselves as advisors, and there's no kind of filter on what you can find on social media. So you get all kinds of opinions. And I fully agree that, you know, scientists themselves have been part and parcel of the problem. We talked about this one particular study, but then more recently, since the release of my most recent video, which was kind of concentrating on the MRI stuff, there's been a paper looking at athletes specifically and showing that there are abnormalities, and I can't remember the exact numbers, but about a third had some cardiac MRI abnormality, but there was no control group. And, you know, so they've just taken a bunch of athletes at random and who've had COVID and just scanned them and showed us the results. Now, there's a whole discussion on Twitter in the kind of ivory tower of cardiac MRI Twitter about whether the images released actually are abnormal. I'll put that to one side. But without a control group, you know, a study like this would just never get published in JAMA Cardiology normally. So that, for a start, tells you something strange is up. But then a few smart people online have been digging through the literature for the last, you know, decade and a half since this technology has existed, and found that in athletes, you'll find all kinds of crazy things on their cardiac MRI scans because they're elite athletes and they've done strange things to their heart. And, you know, we've seen this in veteran athletes, in elite athletes who are a bit younger. And you find all kinds of things, in fact, higher rates than was seen in the COVID-19 paper. So again, you know, there's an acceptance of a much lower grade of evidence at the moment. And it all comes down to the fact that there's a lot of fear about this, you know, disease we still are learning about. And so I've been very sort of apprehensive about saying anything too specific about sports in America. But number one, I'm not in America and I don't really understand the environment there. But number two, you know, I would never want to criticize somebody running a league who's worried about their athletes. And as you say yourself, you know, they're not cardiologists. They're going to listen to what they're told and what people are advising them. And if they feel that they're a realistic risk, then, you know, fair enough. So I sympathize. But if that truly was the main reason, and I've heard kind of conflicting things from different people, then that's a shame, because I don't think that is at all sufficient evidence to cancel something like a sporting league. And indeed, the lead author, you know, in a couple of interviews I've seen, has himself been surprised by the implications of what was published.
Yeah, I think, you know, to the normal abnormal variant, you know, it's funny because people are always surprised when I talk to the patients, I talk to them and say, you know, I'm not sure how things will turn out. I mean, things that you'll survive the anesthetic, but I don't know if you'll have some nausea afterwards or not, because everyone's a little bit different. And we talk maybe about the surgery some, because they all assume I know a lot about surgery because I'm in the room, although I find the surgery boring. But anyway, and I will say, well, you know, it's sometimes hard to know where things are. So sometimes it takes a little bit longer than other times. And they're like, what do you mean? Everyone assumes everybody's exactly the same on the inside, which I find amazing. Because you'd be terrified if you saw someone who looked exactly like you on the outside, right? But so no one accepts the fact that there are variants there. And when it comes to like athletes, you said, I mean, we know that athletes have a lower resting heart rate, for instance. I think most people know that now, but a while ago that was not known, or it was a surprise to people, and they would think people needed heart transplants. You had a resting heart rate in the 40s, right? Young athletes. And so it's hard to even get controls. And this is why science is so messy, and to try and use populations to go to individuals, obviously. And I'm not sure why we have the problems in this country when it comes to disseminating, figuring out the information. But I think overall there's an idea how we think the world should be and how we should respond to this virus. And I'm assuming it's similar to that in the UK, that people find information that confirms their bias. And I think, you know, scientists are just as guilty of this as anyone, because we're all human.
Yeah.
And we try to, in science, tell ourselves, don't be biased, and to try and have a level of humility, a recognition that you can't know everything. And I don't expect politicians at all to be able to do this, because they feed on the fact that there's people want them to do stuff, and that's kind of what they do. How do you see things in the UK playing out right now with the COVID? I mean, you guys are back to school as well, I believe, right? And I mean, you're sort of in a semi-lull with SARS-CoV-2 as far as we know, right?
We are. I mean, we're seeing cases going up quite rapidly at the moment, but not so much from the hospital point of view. We haven't seen, because the majority of new cases at the moment are in younger people, because they've, you know, gone out back to work, and people are now returning to their offices. So the big spike in cases is happening, but it doesn't appear to be at the moment associated with a major uptick in hospital admissions, although they're creeping up. And so from tomorrow, actually, some restrictions are being put back into place. So we're taking a step backwards with a cap on public meetings of six people. I think without wanting to get into a sort of wider debate about everything, because we'd be here all day, but I think the UK has been fairly similar to America in some respects, in that I think our governments were a bit slow to move initially, and I think there've been mixed messages, and the I only speak for the UK here, but there's been very unclear messaging from the government. And so I think at this point, I'm really not confident there's a huge appetite for, if there was an announcement that strict lockdown was going to come back in, I'm not sure the British public are going to go for it like they did before, when they, on the whole, they were very good. So I don't know. At the moment, work feels much more normal. It's pretty much back to normal where I work, you know, in terms of our elective activity as well. So we'll have to see.
Yeah, I think for us, work is back to normal as well. In fact, it's been this way for probably 2 months, outside the fact that we have far more personal protective equipment we have to wear. We have to wear N95s when we're doing intubating procedures. We have to wear eye shields and stuff, although I think I'm not quite sure why that is, but I think this is one of those recommendations. I mean, we're pretty sure it's not a droplet, transmitted disease or virus. It's almost certainly aerosolized. And so there are lots of things we do because, well, we can do it, I guess. But where do you see your, well, I guess you've been doing YouTube for now for a couple of years. Is that correct? And
yeah.
Why did you decide to go and do it? And what has the experience been for you? I mean, I guess, what have you been most surprised by this sort of sideline career?
Yeah, it's kind of become a second career now. I guess I just kind of always had a bit of an interest in making silly sort of movies and things at medical school. And I kind of let a bunch of my hobbies take a back seat when I was going through cardiology training and everything, and then decided that it would be quite fun to start up. And I didn't want to replicate things that were already out there. There are lots of doctors sort of explaining, you know, what is a heart attack, what is diabetes, that kind of thing. So I you know, my kind of strap line I tell people is these are all pretty useless videos. They're clinically not going to help you, but they're interesting. They're just random medical thing, interesting bits of medical science that I quite like. And that was my initial intention. So it was kind of with a emphasis on physiology and things. But then I started making a kind of separate series, looking more at medical statistics and evidence and sort of questioning some of our beliefs in medicine. And that seems to have been pretty popular. You know, YouTube gets a bit of a bad rep, but there's a nice little corner of kind of educational YouTube where actually people are pretty reasonable and interested in quite niche things like this. So it's been a good kind of way to get a bit of information out to the public in a kind of funny way. And certainly with COVID, there's been a big interest in the channel. So I've seen a significant growth in people watching, and initially wasn't that keen to do anything too COVID related, but now it almost became like I felt obliged. But again, I try to take a bit of a different slant on things. So, you know, I think the video that you first watched that led you to talk to me today is how we really have allowed our standards to slip in science in terms of the papers we're looking at during COVID-19.
Yeah, and I think, no question that it's been a problem. And I really enjoy the videos, and I've listened to your interview in the BBC. And so it is taking down some paths I'm sure you never imagined that would occur. Really? That you're doing something as a hobby and for fun. And I would say also YouTube, totally non-medical related, that it has saved me thousands of dollars in repair costs of things that I can fix, from dryers to
car. Place.
Yeah, it's actually amazing. It's incredible, this technology. And you wonder how much, as much as you can deride YouTube for all the terrible things that are on it, it really is a fantastic resource. I mean, and something that have become just used to. It's sort of like the ability to Google something. I mean, 20 years ago, you had a dispute with someone. I shouldn't say to be a dispute. You'd have a conversation. You're not knowing who was the actor in whatever movie. You just had to go to bed and not know what the answer was. You know. And that, you think of it 3 days later in the shower, like, oh, that's who it was. Now, you know, within seconds, right? It's pretty phenomenal, the information. But on the same point, that information can get disseminated, bad information can get disseminated just as easily, which is, again, what we're just sort of discussing today, that you have this all you can find any sort of information to confirm whatever bias you might have. And so it is the rare person who is able to, and I would say with COVID, I'm the same way, that I think you need to have someone who has humility and recognize they don't know everything. They can't predict the future. As you said earlier, some scientist says, oh, this is going to cause lung scarring, or this is going to cause all kinds of problems with hearts, you know, heart disease 10 years from now. There's no way anyone can know that. 10 years from now, we'll know if that was true. Although I think in a lot of these things, and I don't, you can tell me if you agree or not, there are all sorts of things that happen to you, to your body throughout your life. You get exposed to pathogens, viruses all the time. And they probably do have some sort of long-term effect that is, we can't see. And so it could entirely be possible that when you got chickenpox when you're 8, you know, now it causes some problem when you're 45. We'll never know that. You can never design a study or have any way of figuring that out. I mean, it's entirely possible. And if you were to ask a doctor, can COVID-19, can it cause me lung scarring? Like, well, maybe, but we don't know. I mean, like so many things, so many people are using certainty when I think we don't have certainty in this process.
Yes, exactly. And which will travel much further online is the person who's got that very certain answer. So, you know, you're absolutely right that there's so much. If I criticize this, the way this cardiac MRI paper has been interpreted, and then someone just says, well, are you saying that there's no way COVID-19 is going to cause, you know, heart failure in 10 years time? Well, no, I simply don't know that. But you know, we don't look at every potential question with a 50-50 outcome. It's right. It's not even odds that it is or it isn't. It's you know, we have a Bayesian approach. You know, we'll have a pre-test probability. So we start to look for additional information. So, you know, there was a study from 2009 which looked at people with a viral infection. Obviously, it wasn't COVID-19. It wasn't SARS-CoV-2 back then. And had pretty similar MRI findings in athletes to the ones we've seen today. In fact, you know, higher rates of these raised inflammatory readings from the myocardial tissue, and even something called late gadolinium enhancement, which is not just an abstract number that's picked up by the machine. It's actually holdup of dye that we inject in MRI scans that is suggestive of fibrosis. So this is changing the actual characteristic of the tissue itself. And that is thought to be, you know, significant. Seeing late gadolinium enhancement is thought to be analogous to seeing, you know, scarring on the heart. And we've seen that in about a third of the patients in the German study, but it was also seen in this 2009 study. And what was that virus that they were looking at in 2009? It was the common cold, you know, and these athletes had a cold and they had these same MRI findings. And I don't know for sure, but I assume that all of these athletes in 2009 just recovered and have been fine since. We're not hearing about vast swathes of people who've got cold-induced heart failure in the last 10 years. We don't see, you know, long-term influenza related heart failure. There's a possibility it all could contribute, of course, but I think we have to interpret it in the reference frame of what we do have evidence for. So if somebody says, but you know, the underlying thing to this is that, of course, with COVID-19, there is this undercurrent of fear. And so when confronted with a question like, will this cause X in the future, instead of giving the honest answer of I don't know, which doesn't really satisfy anyone, there'll be people who say, yes, this definitely will cause harm, and then that's what goes around the world. Or there'll be people who say, no, there's absolutely no way, I'm positive this is going to be completely trivial and meaningless. And that tends to lead you down an equally damaging garden path, which is one I don't tend to concentrate on so much, because I think there are lots of other people dealing with it who are the kind of real alternative medicine, you know, quacks who will just ignore science and will just present certainty about however they interpret, you know, what's going on.
Well, I think, you know, the answer for us is you need to be discerning in how, in your information, recognize that anyone who tells you for sure they know what's going on, they don't know, because no one can know anything with certainty. and to try and get information from various sources so that you are not continually confirming the bias that you have, whatever that might be, whatever side you're on. And of course, here now I'm making it binary, even though probably, like everything, it's nothing's really truly binary. So where do people find more about you? I mean, obviously, your YouTube page, Midlife Crisis, you're on the Twitter sphere, and where else do people need to keep track of you?
Those are the two places I tend to spend most of my time, to be honest. I've got a website, but I think you can find me at Twitter most of the time. And the channel, I'm going to keep trying to plod on with it. It's a little difficult to squeeze in, but it's certainly something I want to continue because, as you said, it's taken me down some very interesting career avenues, which I never anticipated.
Yeah, that's great. And just like you, COVID-19 has been a blessing and a curse. It's been one I don't enjoy talking about a lot, but it is like an intellectual puzzle in trying to figure out how this sort of what's real, where we're going to get and how we're going to get there. And so from an academic reason, it's sort of been very interesting that way. And it's certainly far more popular. People listen to those episodes more than any other. But I pretty much my show is about what I'm interested in talking about, and COVID-19 is not what I'm interested in talking about all the time. So I try and temper it and not have to do that all the time. But Dr. Rowan Frances from the UK and Midlife Crisis, thank you so much for being on The Paradox. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much, Eric. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what the doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/theparadox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.